Acts 15 is where we're going to be picking up again. What's the big event or the big debate going on in Acts 15? You know, the debate over the Judaizers, and what were the Judaizers teaching? Yeah, they were teaching the necessity of circumcision for Christianity, not just circumcision, but what else? Yeah, all of the law, so that as you're reading the New Testament, you're reading these discussions about the relationship of the law to the church, if you see them just talking about circumcision, know that that's not just circumcision. It really is the entirety of the law. And so this debate happened. What set up the debate in Jerusalem? What happened before that to lead up to this debate? Okay, Gentiles were saved. What happened after that? Yeah, so they went to these different places where the Gentiles were being saved and began to teach that they had to keep the law. What happened when they went to Antioch of Syria? Yes, there was a disagreement between who and the Judaizers? Yeah, between Barnabas and Paul and the Judaizers, and it was such a conflict that the church in Antioch sent Paul and Barnabas and others with them to go down to Jerusalem to discuss the matter with the apostles and the elders of the church in Jerusalem. And one of the reasons for this is because these Judaizers came up to Antioch and to the other places as if they had been sent from the church in Jerusalem. So there's a point here. It's not just that this is where the apostles are, though that I'm sure played a role in that. It is that these Judaizers presented themselves as if they'd come from Jerusalem. And so the church in Antioch is sending to Jerusalem and saying, are you really teaching this? Is this what's going on? Is this what we should be teaching? To trying to work this out, and they're going directly to the source to get the answers here. And so they met together in this public meeting. So you have the apostles and the elders discussing this in the presence of the church at large. And Peter gets up, he begins to speak, and he speaks of how the Gentiles in the household of Cornelius were saved. And remember that what he stresses there is they received the Holy Spirit exactly as the Jews did before they were baptized and without any keeping of the law. And then Paul began to speak, and he and Barnabas began to tell of their ministry among the Gentiles and how God did wonders among them, among the Gentiles. And remember last week we were talking about this, that these signs, these miracles that God did by the hands of the apostles were a confirmation of the message. Mark 16, verse 20, the very last verse of Mark 16, they went out and preached the word everywhere, the Lord working with them and confirming the word through the accompanying signs. So we do have a dual purpose specifically stated in scriptures of confirmation of the messenger and confirmation of the message. We have Paul and Barnabas' testimony, the miracles that God did, as confirmation that they were preaching the true gospel. Then James speaks, he quotes Amos and speaks of the Gentiles being brought to the Lord, you know, ultimately that they will be saved. And he reaches his conclusion, verse 18 again. He says, known to God from eternity are all his works. Therefore I judge that we should not trouble those from among the Gentiles who are turning to God, but that we should write to them to abstain from things polluted by idols. What is that? Things polluted by idols. Yeah, things that have been sacrificed to the idols, so food particularly, but have been sacrificed to the idols. And again, that which is, as we see later in the New Testament, specifically those things which are known to have been sacrificed to idols. So if you're going through the meat market, you go to the local farmer's market and there's just meat on sale, it may or may not have been sacrificed to idols. Paul says, basically, don't ask questions. If your conscience permits you, get the good deal and go home and enjoy it. If somebody comes up to you and says, this was sacrificed to idols, don't eat it for the sake of their conscience. And so that's part of what's going on here, is this not eating things that have been sacrificed to idols, not in any way participating in idolatry, from sexual immorality, which again, there's a deep religious component to this. The pagan worship very much was an immoral worship, so that immorality was a part of their I'll say their liturgy. It was a part of their regular worship in the temple. And so then you have from things strangled and from blood. And again, I think those two are closely related to one another. Meat that has not been properly killed. It's not kosher because it's not been properly drained. And of course, blood itself, you know, that would have been at the very least deeply offensive to the Jews. And then verse 21, he says, "For Moses has had throughout many generations those who preach him in every city, being read in the synagogues every Sabbath." And I want to camp here for a while, because this issue of the Christian's relationship to the law is one that doesn't seem to go away, at least in my experience in the UP. It's a regular occurrence that I'm confronted with someone who is being taught you need to keep the law. Some people go so far as say you need to keep all the law. Some don't go that far and they say you need to keep certain portions of the law. You need to keep the Sabbath. You need to observe the dietary restrictions. And of course, as we come to just our own reading through the Old Testament, we're reading these things. You know, we go to the book of Leviticus and you start reading these regulations about houses or clothing or in diet and such things as that. And there's questions. Do we do this or not? Should I, when I harvest my garden in the fall, should I leave the corners of it unharvested for the poor people or not? And we can't just say, I mean, it's the right answer, but we can't just say, well, we're Christians, we're not under the law anymore. That's true, but it doesn't explain anything. And so what I want to do is really walk through what is our relationship to the Old Testament law. And I want to start with Acts 15. What city does this council take place in? Jerusalem. What nationality was Peter? Jewish. What nationality was James? Jewish. What nationality was Paul? Yeah, so the good chance that the majority of the leadership, if not all the leadership in Jerusalem, is entirely Jewish. We did have, if you remember back in Acts chapter 6, there was a conflict between, if you will, the Hebrew Jews and the Hellenized Jews, those Jews who had kept the Jewish language and pretty much the Jewish culture, and those Jews who were speaking Greek and had adopted more of the Greek or the Roman culture. There was conflict in the church because the Hellenized widows were being neglected in the care for the widows. And so they appointed deacons, and it's noteworthy that these deacons had Grecian names. And so they're more than likely these are Hellenized Jews in the church that are ministering to the widows at large within the body of the church. And so you have a very Jewish body of believers. They are still, all of the evidence says, they're still observing the customs of the Old Testament. They're still participating in temple worship. So they're still offering sacrifices. At this point, I think there's every reason to think they're still doing all of the normal Jewish things, if you want to say it like that. All of the Old Testament, as much as they can, they're still keeping it. And so these men, when they're saying these things, Peter's describing the law as a yoke, which they and their fathers could not bear. It's not coming from a position of, we really don't like the law. It's coming from a position of observance to the law. And so there's two things that have happened prior to this that I think direct the apostles and the elders in Jerusalem to reach this conclusion. We looked at one last week, Acts chapter 10, the vision of the sheet descending from heaven, full of all kinds of animals, clean and unclean, and God telling Peter to rise and kill and eat. There's something even before that that I think really eventually sets the apostles on the path to reaching this conclusion, and that's in Mark chapter 7. So turn back there. Not too long ago in the morning service, we looked at this parable. I believe we looked at it in Matthew, but Mark 7 verse 19 is where we're going to be. But it's this parable of defilement, the source of defilement. It comes in response to the Pharisees' critique that Jesus' disciples ate without first washing their hands. And remember, this isn't just hygiene. This is ritual. This is clean and unclean in a religious sense, because everything they did before they ate, before they touched clean things, they wash their hands in a ceremonial way. And so the Pharisees are rebuking Jesus because his disciples are breaking their traditions about the unclean and clean things. They're making themselves unclean in the eyes of the Pharisees. And so Jesus responds to that, and he begins to tell that it's nothing. Verse 15, "There enters a man from outside, which can defile a man, but the things which come out of him, those are the things that defile him." And so verse 19 is the conclusion to his explanation of that. And he says that what you eat cannot make you religiously unclean, because what you eat cannot affect your immaterial, your spiritual heart. So we recognize what we eat does in some way affect our physical hearts. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about the spiritual heart, the inner man. What you eat doesn't go into your inner man. And he says instead that goes into your stomach and is eliminated. Verse 19, the last phrase is purifying all foods. And there's two ways commonly of reading this. The first way is that Jesus is saying that, you know, this process of digestion and elimination purifies food. So you can eat it and it's fine. And I don't think we can understand Christ in that way, in part because we know that's not actually what happens. You can't just go eat, you know, cheeseburgers every single day and think, well, my body's going to purify it and I'll be fine. We recognize that there are physical consequences of the things we eat, even though they taste really good. And so I don't think he's talking about that at all, but rather that phrase, purifying all foods, I know in the New King James in red indicating it's the words of Jesus, I don't think it should be. I think this is an insertion from Mark, actually, as he's writing this, as he puts in this comment saying that all foods are now pure. Really, it's an awkward phrase in itself. It's been smoothed out in English, but I think it's a bit of an awkward phrase in Greek, just kind of dropped in there. And it is, as Mark is saying, because what goes into a man doesn't defile him, but what comes out of him defiles him, thus all food is now pure. Now, I realize that Mark wrote Mark's gospel after this council in Jerusalem. However, there should have been, and I think there was, this understanding that if what I eat doesn't make me spiritually unclean, then it doesn't matter, as far as the laws of clean and unclean go, what I eat. So you have that. And I think you add that with, again, the command of God to Peter to rise, kill, and eat. It leads them to this point of recognizing, well, the law's not actually that important, at least in the way that the Judaizers were trying to make it important. But rather, they're recognizing that we cannot require anyone to be under the law. And we go to Galatians. In fact, turn there. Galatians chapter 2. The book of Galatians was written right around this time. So it was written within a year of this Jerusalem Council. The Jerusalem Council, we have pretty solid evidence that this took place in 49 AD. So the book of Galatians, depending on your view of Galatians, it may have been written in 49 AD before the Jerusalem Council. It may have been written in 50 AD after the Jerusalem Council. I lean towards the later date myself, but there's good arguments for the earlier date. So the point of all of that, this theology that Paul is presenting in Galatians was absolutely present at the time of the Jerusalem Council. So even if, you know, Paul writes this letter a few months after the council, it's not that he would have come up with this after the fact. I know that for several reasons. Part of that is what's going on in Galatians 2. Paul talking about his rebuke of Peter and the things that he said to Peter in Antioch before the Jerusalem Council. So some of this theology we know was present, so that Paul said it, Barnabas heard it, Peter heard it, and whatever witnesses came down from Antioch heard it, because Paul's rebuke of Peter was a public rebuke. And so there is, at the very, very least, there is the beginning of this theology. You may or may not realize this, but usually working out a theology to bring it down into a concise, clear presentation doesn't happen quickly. especially if you're starting from scratch, but even with good teaching, good information, it usually takes months, sometimes years, to work out a theology in the way that Paul has worked this out in Galatians. And if you've never kind of started from scratch with theology and tried to work it out for yourself, take my word for it. It does take, at least for me, it takes a while. Paul was brilliant, but I still don't think that he did this overnight. This is a process of development, of working through and understanding the real significance, the real effects of his theology. And so all of that to say, what we find in Galatians is theology present at the same time as the Jerusalem Council. In my opinion, it is absolutely theology that informed Peter's conversation about the law. So this is not things that are come up with 10 years after the Jerusalem Council. Really, that's the long and short of what I'm saying there, is this would have been there. I think it was said. That's just my opinion. So Galatians chapter 2, verse 16, he says, "Knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by faith in Jesus Christ," which everybody agreed on that. That second phrase, everyone understood that you're justified by faith in Jesus. That's what Peter was talking about when talking about the household of Cornelius being saved, that they were justified by faith in Jesus. He says, "Even we have believed in Christ Jesus that we might be justified by faith in Christ and not by the works of the law. For by the works of the law, no flesh shall be justified." And again, I think even though this issue was being raised by the Judaizers, in the apostles' mind, there is no question. I don't think this aspect is up for debate even in Jerusalem Council. They know you're justified by faith in Christ, not by the keeping of the law. Before I go any further, just to make sure we're all on the same page, can somebody give me a definition of justification? Yeah, just as if I'd never sinned. I'm going to make it harder than that. It is the divine decree that you are now righteous, that God treats you as righteous. Because of what God has done, he treats me as if I have never sinned. So how do we come to that point of being made absolutely righteous in the eyes of God? It's by what? Yeah, by grace through faith, and faith alone. He says, verse 17, "But if, while we seek to be justified by Christ, we ourselves also are found sinners, is Christ therefore a minister of sin? Certainly not. For if I build again the things which I destroyed, I make myself a transgressor. For I, through the law, died to the law, that I might live to Christ. I have been crucified with Christ." And what he's saying there, we love verse 20, it's a great verse. But when he says, "I've been crucified with Christ," in the context, he's saying, "I've been crucified with Christ to the law," is what he's talking about. So he's saying, "I'm dead to the law. It is no longer I who live by keeping the law, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by" what? "By faith." We are justified by what? By faith. We live as Christians by faith. "I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. I do not set aside the grace of God, for if righteousness comes through the law, then Christ died in vain." It's an incredibly important statement. If anyone is made righteous in the eyes of God by keeping the law, then Jesus didn't need to die. It was a waste of time for him to do that. Then verse 1, he says, "O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you that you should not obey the truth, before whose eyes Jesus Christ was clearly portrayed among you as crucified? This only I want to learn from you. Did you receive the Spirit by the works of the law, or by the hearing of faith?" This is the Cornelius argument. When did Cornelius and his household receive the Spirit? When they believed. Before they were baptized, and apart from any keeping of the law. When did the Galatians receive the Spirit? When they believed. So if they received the Spirit by the hearing of faith, what's the function of the law? What is the need of the law? So he goes on, he says, verse 3, are you so foolish, having begun in the spirit, are you now being made perfect by the flesh? So what he tells us in this discussion of the Christian's relationship to the Old Testament law, part of it is the keeping of the law is not of the spirit, it's of the flesh. The keeping of the law is not yielded to the spirit, it is working in the flesh. It is not walking in the spirit, it is living in the flesh. And I hope there are echoes of Galatians 5 in your mind at this point. We're no longer under the works of the law, and he describes the works of the law, but now we're to live in the Spirit and bear the fruit of the Spirit. Verse 3, therefore he who supplies the Spirit to you and works miracles among you, does he do it by the works of the law or by the hearing of faith? So again, the miracles that were testing the messenger and the message, were the miracles given to them by the keeping of the law or by the hearing of faith? And it goes on and he says, verse 6, just as Abraham believed God and it was counted to him for righteousness, therefore know that only those who are of faith are sons of Abraham. And the scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel to Abraham beforehand, saying, in you all the nations shall be blessed. So then those who are of faith are blessed with believing Abraham, which for the Jews, this is a devastating argument. Abraham, their father, the one who starts off the whole line of Israel. Before Abraham, there is no Israel. Abraham is the beginning of this. He was not justified by keeping the law. Long before Abraham was circumcised, he was justified by faith. And then he says in verse 10, for as many as are of the works of the law are under the curse. Now Paul says, you did not receive the Spirit by the keeping of the law, but by faith. Now he says that if you're under the law, you're under a curse, because it is written, cursed is everyone who does not continue in all things which are written in the book of the law to do them. According to verse 10, how many of those things in the law must be done? If you're going to do the law, how much of it are you supposed to do? You have to do all of it, everything. He's quoting Deuteronomy, given to Israel, saying, you have to keep all the law. And Paul is saying, this is a curse because you can't keep all the law. But what I want to point out, part of what Paul's statement here is that the law of Moses is an indivisible unit. You may have heard people talk about the civil, the ceremonial, and the moral laws of Israel. So we take the Ten Commandments. Those are the moral laws. The laws of sacrifices and clean and unclean, those are the ceremonial laws. They're related to worship. The civil laws are laws like you build a parapet, a railing around the roof of your house. That's a civil law telling you how to relate to others in the Jewish society. And there's help in that distinction. You know, if you want to categorize portions of the law, there's help in that. At the same time, the Bible contains no hint of that distinction. It's not there. What the Bible tells us is the law is the law. That's it. It's a unit. So that James says, if any man shall keep the whole law and yet offend in how much? One point, he is guilty of all. So you cannot say, according to Paul and James both, I am observing the law except I eat shrimp every once in a while. You are guilty of all of it. It's a single unit. And what Paul is saying here in verse 10 is if you're going to place yourself under the law, then you're under all of it. If you want to see this lived out in real life, I have in my office a book called The Year of Living Biblically. It's a fascinating book because an ethnic Jew living in America decided to try to reconnect with Judaism. He really was kind of just culturally Jewish, but that was it. And so part of what he did is he decided to try to observe the law in every respect. And he realized very, very quickly he couldn't keep the law. And the man was very insightful in recognizing that thou shalt not covet, 10th commandment. You walk down the sidewalk in New York and there's billboards and advertising everywhere. It's like, you can't help but covet. It's right in front of you. The one that really amuses me is he came to the command to stone adulterers. And he was wrestling to him, how do I obey this? And so apparently he was interacting, he was talking with somebody that he knew was an adulterer, was in their presence, close enough to where he could do this. And so what he did is he reached down and picked up a few small pebbles and threw them at their shoes. And he stoned the adulterer. And I think he was portraying it as comedic, but realizing this is impossible. So if you want to see somebody really try to work this out, that's a good place to see this. And in showing you can't keep the law. None of us are emotionally or physically or spiritually capable of keeping the whole law, which is why we're under a curse. That's why Paul's about to say the law was a schoolmaster, is a teacher to take us to Jesus. Because it shows us our inability to be righteous. Verse 12, it says, yet the law is not of faith, but the man who does them, the commandments of the law, shall live by them. And so we have here, contemporary with the Jerusalem Council, this theology at the same time as the Jerusalem Council, is this recognition that salvation is by faith and faith alone. That putting yourself under the law in any part of it as having anything to do with salvation is cursing. It's not life-giving, but it condemns. It is not of the spirit, but it is of the flesh. That is why I wish I had time to go to 2 Corinthians chapter 3, but go read there and Paul talking about the ministration written in stones, the ministry carved in stones. It's the commandments. It had a glory. It was glorious, but it wasn't life-bringing, and its glory was greatly inferior to the glory of the gospel. So you look at the moon. I think just a couple weeks ago, I was coming to church one morning, and the moon was full, and it was just starting to set over Indian Lake. And a very brilliant moon, bright morning, and you see the reflection bouncing off the water and all of that. Just incredibly glorious picture. And we look at the moon, and it is a glory. Especially as we see it from Earth. But you put the glory of the moon up beside the glory of the sun, and the moon's just a cold and dead rock. The law is holy and just and good, but its glory does not compare to the glory of the gospel. And one final thing I'd say about all of this is Hebrews chapter 7. It tells us very specifically that if one part of the law is changed, then the whole thing is changed. In Hebrews, the discussion is the priesthood of Christ. If Christ is now our priest, we do not need the Levitical priest, then the law is changed. If I don't need sacrifices because of the sacrifice of Christ, the law is changed. And what he says just a few verses after that is because it is changed. Remember, this law is not just rules. It's a covenant. It's contractual obligations that are defining the relationship between lawgiver and law receiver. And if the law in that, if the obligations in that covenant are changed, the covenant is changed. To say it a different way, if the covenant is changed and the obligations are changed, what in fact happens is those original covenant obligations are annulled. No longer under them. That's why Paul uses the example. He compares the Christian's relationship to the law now to the death of a spouse. So when your spouse dies, are you any longer under the marriage covenant and all of the obligations to them? No, not at all. In the same way, because of Christ, because the law has been changed, a new covenant has been given, the old covenant obligations no longer apply. They're no longer in force. Go back now to Acts chapter 15. That's what's going on. Again, especially that Galatian theology, that is present here in this council. That's the understanding that they have, that this law is not life-giving, it's not salvation-giving, it's not spirit-bringing, but justification, life, and spirit come through faith. Therefore, we are not going to require the Gentiles to obey the law. Rather, they give them these four obligations. Most of these are absolutes. And there's specific issues that they need to be reminded of because of their cultural setting. There's obligations on the Gentiles for their own sake. And also, at the very least, when we're talking about things strangled in blood, they're giving them instructions so they do not offend their Jewish brethren. That statement there, because they have people in every city, there are those who teach and read Moses. There are some who say the point of these instructions were to get them started, and then as they go to synagogue, they'll learn the rest of the laws and obey them that way. There's no foundation to that at all. Again, because part of what I've already said, you can't take the law piecemeal. You can't say, well, start obeying this, and then as we go on, we'll add and add and add to this. It's all or nothing. If you go back and you read the Old Testament, the laws regarding proselytes, those who would come in and participate in the worship with the Jews, it wasn't, well, come in and start this and we'll get you involved and then eventually, you know, we'll give you everything, you'll have to keep everything. It was, you cannot participate in the feast and sacrifices until you're doing everything. There was no exclusions, there were no Gentile exemptions. You did it all or you weren't in. And so this idea that this was kind of a piecemeal approach to ramp them up to full obedience, just there's no biblical foundation for it at all. And I stress all of this as I started out in saying that we run into this, or at least I run into this regularly. Those who are saying you need to follow the dietary laws and keep the Sabbath, some of them are preaching a false gospel. I will not and cannot say all of them are. Some of them do believe the gospel, they are saved by faith, and they are misunderstanding this issue. Some of them, though, are preaching a false gospel. They are requiring law-keeping for salvation. For you to make it to heaven, you have to keep the Sabbath. That's absolutely a core tenet in the official doctrines of the Seventh-day Adventist movement. It's still distributed in Ellen G. White's writings. It's not gone away. That is a different gospel. Some of you may have heard of Messianic Christianity. It kind of rises and bobs up and down every once in a while. I see people who interact with it. And the gist of it is, again, there's levels of this, but the worst of it is when they begin to teach that Christians should be keeping the laws. Yes, you're saved by faith in Jesus. Now that you're saved, you need to keep the laws. That's Judaizing. It's classic Judaizing. And that is a false gospel. Again, not everybody in the movement or that buys into it is unsaved. There are many that are saved by faith through Christ, even though they believe that. But we're not under any obligation to the law. If you want to read and study how they did the sacrifices and the feast and festivals, it's incredibly informative, but it's not at all binding. I will say one other thing was many of these Messianic Christian groups, at least the ones I've seen, they deny the Trinity. They are, God alone is one God. They are not Trinitarian. They deny that Jesus is God. And so those groups that deny the Trinity are apostate groups. They are false teachers. So as you're confronted with this, whenever you bump into it, recognize the issue here is a whole lot bigger than do we come to church on Saturday or Sunday. These are gospel issues. And we need to recognize how significant they are, and we need to recognize the clear New Testament response to those issues was, you are not under the law.